Well, good morning once again. My name is David Lawton. I'm the Director of Markets at the Financial Conduct Authority in London, but I also have the privilege of being one of the co-chairs of the IOSCO Committee 7 on commodity derivatives, and it's my great pleasure to be moderating our session today. I'm very pleased to be joined by a very distinguished set of panelists. Reading from my right, we have Jeff Harris, Professor of Finance at Syracuse University, Scott O'Malia, who is a commissioner at the CFTC, Bahatin Bouyuk-Sahin, who is an advisor to the Bank of Canada, and then David Fife, who is the head of market research and analysis at Gunvor. What we're going to do in our session is to explore some of the issues which lie at the interface between physical commodity markets and commodity derivatives. And we're going to do that in two ways. Each of our panelists is going to present one aspect of that interaction, and that will take up most of our morning session. And then when we come back in the afternoon, we're going to have a more traditional interactive panel session where we'll have a chance to debate some of the issues that have been put on the table this morning and have some time for questions from the audience. We will also take a short coffee break mid-morning just to get a chance to stretch your legs and get some refreshments. So I'm going to start with just a very brief introduction to some of the issues to set the scene and to talk a little bit about what IOSCO has been doing in this space, and then we'll hand over to the other panelists to work through some of the detail. I really want to set the scene by looking at two sorts of issue. Firstly, just stepping back and looking at some of the big picture things that have been happening in commodity and commodity derivative markets more generally, and then finishing by just laying out the work streams that IOSCO and particularly C7 has been taking forward. It's not going to work. Perhaps I'm pointing this at the wrong thing. Right. Maybe the batteries run out straight away. It's not happening.
There should be this one. Okay.
Well, let me carry on while the technology is being replaced. I think one of the challenges for financial market regulators in this space is the boundary question about whether we're about commodity derivatives or physical commodity markets. And actually, one of the themes, I think, of our session will be that increasingly we are drawn into the overlap between the two. But historically, of course, we have been focusing very much on commodity derivative markets, where our goals have been to ensure that those markets work well in terms of being venues for price formation and for risk management. And they have been, I think, the core drivers for our work historically. But the world is changing, and I want to talk very briefly about four key factors which are driving that change. Okay, thank you. Perfect. The first, of course, is globalization. And in the commodity space, this is overwhelmingly actually a story of China's growth since China joined the WTO. This chart shows across all commodities, China's production and consumption. And you can see actually a massive increase in both over the last 10 years. And I think the production figures are probably capturing the finished products rather than the raw materials. So you can see actually that net imports from China have significantly increased in the last 10 years. And that's coincided with a commodities super cycle, a massive increase in prices, which might now be coming to an end. So that's the first trend, globalization. The second is financialization. And I think there are probably two points to pick out here. The first is the changing composition of players who are active in commodity and commodity derivatives markets. Increasingly, of course, there's been talk about the role of financial market participants in commodity markets, and that will be a theme that Jeff in particular will pick up. But the second aspect of financialization is the changing nature of price correlations between commodity markets and other markets. This chart shows the correlation between commodity indices and equity prices, and you can see that for the most part, commodities are not correlated with equity prices, and they've traditionally been an asset class that people want to move into as a way of offsetting equity market changes. In the last half dozen years, that has changed dramatically, and commodity markets are now strongly correlated with financial markets. Of course, when commodity prices are driven by demand, there's naturally more correlation with financial market assets, as this indicates a dependence on general economic performance. More recently, in the last year or so, we're seeing commodity prices being driven by supply constraints or fears of constraints, and that leads to moves that perhaps are less correlated with other assets. And of course, one macroeconomic question is whether that's a blip or we are moving back to those pre-crisis conditions where you saw commodity markets less correlated with financial assets. The third trend is electronification, by which I mean the changing nature of the microstructure of commodity derivative markets. Developments in technology over the last few years are seeing a dramatic move away from open outcry derivatives markets into markets which are fully electronic. There are not many major marketplaces now around the world which operate an open outcry market, even as an adjunct to their electronic trading platform. And the key to electronification is that market participation becomes more open. It allows for a much greater range of market participants to be able to play. Anyone essentially with a computer can now trade commodity derivatives. This chart shows the trend in electronic trading of corn and wheat. For other markets such as oil, the shift happened a little bit earlier, but it's a general trend across all key markets. And then the fourth trend is what I've called politicization. I think I'm probably allowed to do that as a regulator. By which I mean a growing political interest in what's happening in commodity markets and the interaction between physical commodity prices and financial market derivatives. That's manifested itself in a number of issues, of course, concern over price spikes, concern over supply constraints, growing competition for what might be limited global resources, and controversy over the impact that different types of player might be having in those markets. And then there's been a whole raft of regulatory change which has had an impact on these markets. I've listed a few here, particularly from a European perspective, which I know most. I think the key thing about these regulatory changes is that they have not been directly or specifically brought forward to deal with commodities, but there have been important side pockets of key initiatives which have had impact on commodities, whether it's been changes from a prudential perspective, tackling challenges in the OTC derivatives markets, and looking to strengthen market abuse regimes. All those things have been done for more broad regulatory reasons rather than commodity-specific reasons, but they have had and will have significant impact on commodity markets. So given that background, what's actually happening in the marketplace itself? Well, this looks at what's been happening in the OTC derivatives space. And I particularly want to draw your attention to the pie chart in the bottom right-hand corner. This shows the total market for OTC derivatives. And you can see that the commodities proportion of that is a very small percentage of total OTC markets. Of course, the aggregate volume, as the chart on the left-hand side shows, has spiked up, particularly over the second 5 years of the first decade of the century, but it's fallen back in quantitative terms, particularly as there has been a move to more active management of bilateral exposures. The second trend, of course, in the OTC space is a move to more clearing of such derivatives. That is something, of course, that regulation will continue to push. And currently you see some geographical differences in the proportion of different markets which are cleared. The chart here shows power and gas, for example, which is not particularly heavily cleared in Europe, whereas in the US, partly because of the different commercial attractiveness of the offering in the US, does show a greater proportion of clearing. On the exchange-traded side, again, commodity derivatives are a relatively small proportion of exchange volumes. Futures open interest is around $1 trillion, which actually compares with the market capitalization of Apple of some $400 billion. So $1 trillion total open interest in commodity derivatives versus the market cap of Apple, $400 billion, actually shows the relatively small scale of commodity derivative markets. And looking globally, again, the growth in exchange trading has very much been a story from outside the traditional developed markets. Chinese and Indian exchanges in particular have been showing particularly strong growth over the past decade or so. On the investor side, obviously there has been a run-up in the past 10 years or so in commodities as an investable asset class. In the past couple of years, actually, that's been steady. And to the extent we've seen inflows in the last couple of years, they've been very much into precious metals, perhaps as a defensive play, store of value, rather than an investable class in itself. The key point about this slide is that different market participants see different challenges from what regulators are doing. Depends on where you are in the transaction chain as the thing that you're most concerned about. I suppose the key point is that everybody's concerned about at least one thing, given the range of things that are happening in the regulatory space. There's also the rising reputational risk from a regulatory point of view because of the growing societal and political interest in commodities. This is a quote from, I think, a poll that was taken in the European Parliament about what are the issues from an environmental perspective that are top of the agenda, and the majority vote went to products that allow speculation in food. So rising reputational risk from a regulatory point of view. We are seen as being at the forefront of needing to tackle these wider issues. These markets, of course, then present a wide range of challenges, not just around ensuring effective price formation and risk transfer, which I talked about at the beginning, but a whole range of other issues that are now coming onto the table. Many of these issues, of course, are then flowing back onto other market participants. Banks are finding commodity markets an increasingly difficult environment right now. Declining revenues from the peak of earlier in the century, and of course increasing political challenge around the activities that they are involved in, particularly the interaction with physical markets and their participation in such markets. Growing concern around the rise on the flip side of trading companies, so non-financial market participants, increasingly important in the trading of commodities, and questions around whether any of these firms are now too big to fail, and of course as non-regulated firms outside the purview of financial market regulators. So what has IOSCO been doing against this background? Well, a whole range of things, beginning with establishing principles for the regulation and supervision of commodity derivative markets, and then in the last couple of years looking specifically at some issues around benchmarks. There have been two tracks to that. We have agreed some benchmarks for those price reporting agencies that are active in the oil market space, and then earlier this year we agreed some principles more generally for the compilation of a whole range of benchmarks. And of course, this has been in the context of broader work that we've been doing to strengthen OTC derivative markets, bringing particularly more transparency to the reporting of trades. And from an organisational point of view, this has culminated in the formal establishment of a standing committee, C7, on commodity derivatives, translating it from its previous status as a task force into a proper standing committee. Probably a real sign that these issues have arrived and matured on IOSCO's agenda. So the principles for commodity derivatives markets really try to scope out what, from a regulatory perspective, are the key areas that sound and holistic regulation ought to cover, ranging from things around contract design, how surveillance should be done, tools that should be available to regulators and frontline exchanges to be able to deal with challenges that might lead to disorderly markets, and then, of course, things that need to be in place to enable effective enforcement and information sharing. We established those principles around about 3 years ago, and we've already had an exercise of assessment looking at how jurisdictions measure up against those principles, which actually concluded that jurisdictions measure up pretty well, and we gave a report to that effect to the G20 at the end of last year. The principles for oil PRAs are very much focusing on the integrity of a key set of benchmarks which underpin an important asset class in the commodity derivatives space. This has been a challenging agenda to move forward because obviously the price reporting agencies themselves are unregulated, and the submission of information to such agencies is also both unregulated and largely done by entities that are outside the purview of financial market regulation. So we've had the challenge as IOSCO to develop some principles and then look to the market participants, to the PRAs and the submitters, to take on complying with them on a voluntary basis. The good news is that on the basis of what we have seen so far, the PRAs do indeed seem to be engaging effectively with the principles and looking to comply with them. We will be doing, as IOSCO, a final report on the first phase of compliance early next year, but the evidence that we have been gathering so far suggests that the PRAs are engaging effectively with the principles. And the key goals of the principles really is to make more transparent the methodologies that PRAs use to compile their assessments, and to make more transparent the data sources that they use, and particularly how they treat data which is derived from transactions, and how they use judgment when they need to make assessments that can't be embedded in transactional data. The key thrust of the principles is to make that a lot more transparent, such that market participants can be clear how those assessments have been formed. And then finally, a piece of work that has just been approved by the IOSCO board for C7 to take forward is to do a little bit more analysis of the physical storage arrangements which underpin physically settled derivative contracts. This has been an issue which has been live across a range of asset classes, particularly, of course, metals and aluminium, over the past year or so. And we thought it would be a good point for IOSCO to run the rule over the storage arrangements that marketplaces use to underpin physically settled contracts. So that's a piece of work that's getting underway now in C7, just to flag that. So really, just to conclude my introductory remarks, commodity markets and commodity derivative markets pose a set of quite specific regulatory challenges. Historically, financial market regulators have focused on commodity derivative markets, but increasingly that interface between derivatives and the physical markets is coming onto our table, partly because of the changing nature of those markets. We talked about the drivers that are pushing forward some of those changes, and the rise up on the political agenda of the importance of these markets and the challenges that they are producing. I think that then opens up a number of issues that we'll want to explore during the course of this panel. So I will stop there and hand over first to Jeff, who is going to explore some of the financialization issues that we put on the table. Jeff.
Thank you, David. So I think I will start by just summarizing, I think, where David left off. This is an exciting place to be, I think, doing research and looking at the interface between commodity markets, the physical markets themselves, and the financial traders who take positions in these markets. There's not only a number of different challenges, of course, but there's a number of different interfaces with the international community. There's a number of interfaces even within countries in regulating these spaces. And of course, the question about what's been going on with prices, price changes, return volatility is at the heart of many of our concerns, of course, with food products and oil products, where consumers are actually requiring these for necessities. The sources, and what I'll try to focus on today is the sources that we can identify, at least from the U.S. perspective, and what we've done with data, questioning on whether these markets have been driven by uncertainty in the financial crisis, by poor risk management, by some sort of unknown animal spirits, or maybe some trading, perhaps, that have been going on in these markets. And of course, I think one of the bottom line and my sort of assessment of this is financial markets are always by necessity looking forward. And I think financial markets tend to be blamed for things that are sort of misperceptions of they're delivering a message of commodity shortages in supply or demand or the storage of commodities. And of course, sometimes we have a tendency to shoot the messenger. And when the markets deliver a price that we don't agree with, we tend to blame the market rather than the actual physical setting that we're dealing with in the commodity. Just thought we have Commissioner O'Malley here, but just here's a little summary of where we are in the United States with some rules regarding commodity derivatives. We have 42 CFTC rules that have passed in the U.S. Those include things related to the physical market, like home heating oil contracts, where we've taken an exception to make sure we don't interrupt that market by disrupting the supplies there. We've had a clearing mandate for a number of the over-the-counter swaps. And of course, in the U.S., we've made exemptions for end users with the recognition that traders that are taking positions in the physical commodity are a little different than the financial traders that might be in the marketplace. We also have some things on the investment fund. And of course, this is work in progress in the U.S., and maybe we'll hear a little bit more about that from Commissioner O'Malley. Some of the sticking points in U.S. debate about these, the first one, of course, is the U.S. has the rule where we are supposed to, as regulators, determine whether the efficiency, competition, and capital formation of any rule passed affects the marketplace, which, of course, requires a cost-benefit analysis. I spent a few years as the chief economist at the CFTC, and this is an entirely appropriate way to look at regulation, and it's generated a number of research outcomes that I can present to you today. This process was allegedly minimal or lacking in some of the first core challenges from the U.S. The first one was the position limit rule, which stated that we were going to expand position limits into the energy markets in the U.S. The lawsuit was filed, and of course, there are some quotes here that I put in my slide to say that, of course, the Commission shall establish limits on the amount of positions, and they shall fix position limits. And what the judge in this case just about a year ago pointed out is that these are extra phrases in that particular statement, that the regulation and the regulatory body is supposed to establish limits as appropriate or as may be necessary. And those were determined in the United States to be deficient in the first challenge to this court case. And of course, what the courts determined was that the regulator was an incumbent upon them to deploy their expert judgment in what was going on in these markets before they established a rule that could be supported in the courts. What we mean by financialization, David, I think, gave a nice overview for. And of course, this is the concern about higher prices, volatility, and then what is going on in the financial markets for correlations among these assets. Commodity index funds have been blamed and have been pointed to as a source of some of these problems. Back when I was the chief economist, one of the things the U.S. started producing was an index investment data that's available publicly online on a monthly basis in the last few years and started on a quarterly basis back in December 2007. So we have a large amount of information now, at least for a few years, looking at what the behavior of these funds are in the actually index classes. We also have some concern about commodity mutual funds, hedge funds, and other professional traders who try to time the market. And of course, those mutual funds and other funds are included in the publicly released data from the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission on a weekly basis for everyone to see. The other concern we've had recently is, of course, with high-frequency trading and whether these new traders are somehow driving results of the marketplace or volatility in the commodity space. So what data do we have available? It tends to be very powerful data, large trader data with every participant put out to the investing public on a weekly basis, collected by the CFTC at least on a daily basis, and of course packaged for the investing public so that the worldwide as a whole market participants can actually see what's going on in these markets. So what I've highlighted there is the swap dealers, hedge funds, are otherwise known as managed money, and those where a lot of the research at least has focused on the behavior of traders in the marketplace. The first thing we have to, I think, recognize as regulators is there is a large amount of distrust, I believe, between financial players and the commodity users of the physical commodity themselves. There's long been a history, at least in the United States, of farmers, agriculture producers, being skeptical of the bankers, the financiers, and the people who handle trades in the marketplace. Those traders are simply not, of course, involved with production, delivery, or consumption necessarily of these commodities. And then the question comes up, are they somehow manipulating the market? There's been price patterns that appear to be bubbles. There are ways that Financial traders, of course, can cause information cascades or herding behavior that make prices move beyond what we'd expect them to do in the fundamental rational expectations. And of course, this has been long understood as a valid concern. It's an absolutely positively valid concern. In fact, the reason the United States has put out a lot of this data is to satisfy the demand for shedding light on these problems and being able to see to the investing public, releasing to the public what is going on in these markets. So, of course, what do we know about the marketplace? Managed money, hedge funds, that grew significantly. David put some charts up between 2000 and 2008. Index money investment has grown substantially over the same period. And the one thing that David highlighted, I believe, that I have a few points on too, is that that index money has actually leveled off in the recent few years. The remedy that we've taken as regulators and in the United States typically has been to shine more light on these markets. More transparency. We've had these enhanced trader reports in the United States since 2009, splitting out managed money and hedge funds from the index money. We've had index reports, like I mentioned, since 2008. This just is a highlight of what happens from the CFTC data that's publicly available. Index money was rising in the early 2000s, but at least over the last 6 years appears to have leveled off. And one of the concerns we have now is what happens to the marketplace if this money goes away, if we prohibit banks and other financial institutions from playing a role in this marketplace. What is the uncertain nature of what happens if these traders simply cease to trade in the marketplace? Just wanted to highlight a few research projects, some of them done by me, some by our fellow panelist Bahatin today. We do know that swap dealers in particular take long-only positions in futures markets, but of course futures expire. And one thing that we've recognized is that rolling behavior can be disruptive. If we have a huge amount of volume on one side of the marketplace, we can disrupt the marketplace. And regulators need to be cognizant of that and approving and monitoring the markets when rolling happens from period to period. The other thing we do know, though, is that the index money investment has actually brought information from over-the-counter markets. Financial traders who trade in the over-the-counter market commonly use the established exchanges to lay off their risk. And, of course, that improves hedging opportunities for the physical traders. If you have a position in the physical market, it's nice to have a counterparty on the other side of that trade when you go to market to try to sell your product. Across commodities and across time, there happens to be, at least historically over the last few years, no relationship between price changes and position changes. And so that's been an interesting and perhaps disturbing point that's been hard to establish or hard to be credible, for instance, in the marketplace. But the research has basically come to the conclusion that if you plot position changes of index funds over time, they actually are mostly uncorrelated with price changes. And in fact, over time, there's a rebalancing effect that happens in an index fund that actually produces a countercyclical relationship from the rebalancing effect. So I just have a slide here that shows this, what happened in this oil price spike back in 2007. And the blue line here is just oil prices. And the green triangles signify the index fund positions. And as you can see, we had a little bit of growth in the oil price. But as the price started to spike, what happens in the marketplace is an index fund becomes overweighted with the oil, and then that index fund ends up selling off when the prices spike. So this is the countercyclical nature that we've seen of index fund money investment when prices spike. It tends to be countercyclical. The other class of traders that we're worried about, of course, are speculators known as hedge funds or managed money. There's been a few research studies on these traders. Generally speaking, even though they're not transparent to most people and their positions aren't, we get those reports in the commodity markets. And in the commodity markets, there's some evidence that they actually serve to reduce volatility. They end up being more momentum traders, where they actually move with the price changes, but they actually don't lead any price changes in the marketplace. And the one concern, of course, would be whether these traders are herding in some respect, trading irrationally on one side of the market or the other. And of course, what we've found, at least with CFTC data, is that the hurting tends to be countercyclical as well. When there's a large number of hedge funds buying, it tends to be when prices are falling, and there's a large number of hedge funds selling when prices are actually going up. One other recent phenomenon that I mentioned earlier is the high-frequency trading debate on whether these traders using computers remotely, trading in and out of commodities, are affecting volatility or price changes. We've just had a recent FIA study released by Nick Bolin and Robert Whaley at Vanderbilt, and actually shows that they demonstrate in their case that there is no effect on short-term volatility, at least in these markets, from these traders either. The one link that you have between physical and financial trading is highlighted in this graph by the Energy Information Administration from the U.S. And what I've plotted here, what they've plotted, is the price of oil on the vertical axis and a little bit over the excess storage capacity, linking the financial market to the actual physical commodity. And as you can see here, as we move through time, one nature of the prices spiking, but the prices historically, at least back in 2007, spiked when we got close to zero in the physical supply of excess capacity outside of Saudi Arabia. So when we get to the capacity of excess supply getting to be zero, we do see that there's a price response and that traders are willing to buy and pay ever more for a barrel of oil when there's no oil to be found in the marketplace. Interestingly enough, I've put on here one of the pink lines, or the pink dots, and this has happened since actually this oil price spike in 2008. And the question in my mind as an economist might be to look at what's happening with those pink dots in the years following. From a regulatory perspective, we seem to find a price spike in the middle there that seems not to be related to the physical supply or the excess capacity outside of Saudi. So these are some of the interesting things we can do with marketplace linkages. And the linkages that come forward, of course, have caused some problems in agricultural futures markets in the United States as well. We had an issue in the United States a few years ago where there was no convergence between the spot price and futures prices at expiration. The general result of this was that the futures price lagged above the spot price, and of course, that didn't make the farming community happy. They looked at futures price and saw a higher price than they were getting for their own spot commodity for selling in the marketplace. Studies of this from the University of Illinois and other places have shown that some of this is related, of course, to storage of commercial flow of product. So it's actually related to this physical nature of the commodities that are traded. The regulatory solution of this was to put together a CFTC coordinated effort with the CME group and tried to implement variable storage costs for some of these agricultural products a few years ago. And of course, the incentive there would be to actually provide an incentive to move physical product through the storage facilities. And since this implementation of the variable storage rate, we've had very few problems in convergence in the marketplace. So there are some innovative things that regulatory agencies can do, and coalescing and determining and trying to come to some solution without outright bans of physical trading or financial trading. So the summary of, I guess, from what I've come to conclude over years of studying these markets is that prudent regulation has been actually the rule of law for the last few years. The concerns that we have, of course, between the linkages between physical and financial traders are really real. Information is important in alleviating fears and looking at supply and demand characteristics. Having accurate information, like David mentioned, from oil price reporting agencies is important. And if that information is flawed or if that information is lacking from China or from India, we have to be careful about making regulatory assumptions about what supply and demand might be. The results, I think, my reading of the research in this area is that, of course, regulation should encourage broad participation with regulatory oversight, of course, but that regulatory oversight should recognize that a broad participation base and a large number of people buying and selling actually provide better hedging strategies for those people who are using and producing the commodity itself. I guess the bottom line from my standpoint is that you shouldn't shoot the messenger. The financial markets are forward-looking. They're always going to be forward-looking. people making investments, looking ahead on what good investments might be in the marketplace. And of course, this is a forum and many other forums to coordinate the regulatory efforts on this part. There's been some recent controversy with the CFTC and FERC in jurisdictional relationships. All of these interfaces between physical and financial markets require some sort of memorandum of understanding, some understanding of the information and sharing of that information among regulatory bodies. And for my bottom line, I would just encourage us to keep that in mind. The regulatory environment, I think, over the last 5 years has been very robust, and I think should continue to be prudent in that respect. Thanks.
Great. Thanks so much indeed, Jeff. That was a very masterful overview, particularly of the evidence in the United States. Put on the table a number of issues that I think we'll want to get into in more depth as the morning goes on and when we have our panel this afternoon. But one question, if I might just reflect back straight away, is that I think the message from the research that you are presenting is that the big picture story is that financial market players are not driving prices in the markets that have been looked at. If that is the conclusion from the academic research, why is it that that is still heavily disputed? Why is it that people take a different view from you? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that might get at some of the politicization of the process. My impression is, and I think there's economists are blamed for this a lot, is that you see what you want to see in the data. We've had a number of people using extracts of CFTC data, for instance, and trying to show the opposite when, in fact, they're using flawed data. And I think having more accurate and more robust data characteristics and trusting what comes out of the data is the important part in the assessment that we have. One of the problems of commodity futures in physical markets in particular is that there is a large amount of data that just doesn't exist. If we're looking at an oil market and we have no data from consumption in India, if we have no storage data from China, we have 40% of the world's population that doesn't contribute to supply and demand characteristics. And so we're at sort of the nature of our beast is to try to say, well, we're doing studies on 60% of the data that we have. So that always leaves room, I think, then for the politicization to say, well, what you don't know is what we don't know, and therefore it must be something nefarious.
I guess that's good news for academic researchers, which means that, you know, there's still more to do. Let's hand over to David now and get a perspective from the physical side of the markets. David.
Thank you, David. As you suggest, I'm going to try and set out very much a sort of eagle-eye view from the industrial perspective. I've split the presentation into sort of three parts. The first is, I think, necessary to tell you a little bit about Gunvor, not for PR purposes, but just so that you understand where we sit within the commodity market, and therefore helps explain some of the positions we take as regard the interaction between the physical and financial side and the regulation program and how it affects, how it's likely to affect our business. Then talk a little bit about the nature of the physical markets that we operate in, and then I'll just try and end up with a couple of issues we have with the evolving regulatory process as it affects our day-to-day activity in the physical commodity business. Gunvor, I mean, I should explain, is a private company, began life in 1999, primarily as a trader of Russian crude oil out of Russia into the European markets. But as you'll see in a moment, it's grown very sharply, and it indeed has diversified, but very much remaining in a physical market player in the physical space. Before we do that, however, I think it's interesting to consider the sort of interchange between two key policy strands that have been at play in terms of formulating regulations since 2008. And the first of those clearly were the initiatives that came out of the G7 and from the Riyadh process, which was very much raising concerns about high and rising energy prices, oil in particular, and the degree of volatility within those prices. And obviously that set off a fairly extensive program of research, some of which Jeff has referred to, looking into the causes of volatility in markets, and indeed the interchange between the physical and the financial in terms of price formation. And the second strand, of course, which you're all very familiar with, is surrounding some of the G20 mandates on minimizing systemic risk in financial markets. Now, of course, these policy strands are, of course, related, but I think it at least deserves some examination as to whether those two policy objectives at times can be entirely compatible, or whether sometimes there's a degree of conflict between regulatory effort on the financial side and a desire amongst consumers and governments as a whole for more stable or indeed lower energy prices. And I think it's a sort of a trade-off that we have to bear in mind throughout our discussion today. A little bit about Gunvor. As I said, we're embedded in the physical supply chain. We're fundamentally a trading company and a logistics company. So the basis of our business model is very much physical. And the trading companies, the independent trading companies, numbering five or six amongst the larger concerns, traditionally have been involved in the midstream part of the business. And by that I mean transportation, storage, blending, and transportation of both crude oil and refined petroleum products. But more recently, a lot of these physical trading houses have also moved or have diversified across the value chain. Some have moved into the upstream, actually producing oil and gas or coal. Others have gone into refining, and that has certainly been the case in terms of Gunvor. And others have moved into right downstream into marketing of finished energy and commodity products. We'll talk in a moment about the rationale for this diversification. But I think the important thing to bear in mind is that these are not haphazard investments in assets. It's investments made in physical assets, which allow optionality to our trading operations. So the investment in assets is very much driven by the portfolio of trading assets that we already have. The trading has to benefit the asset, and the asset has to bring an extra degree of optionality and risk diversification to our trading operations. And at the core, although Gunvor as a company has expanded very rapidly and moved into physical assets, we still see ourselves primarily as a logistics and trading company. That's a quick list. You can look at the slides at your leisure later, but we have extensive interests in coal mining across three continents. We have a small presence in upstream oil in the Caspian. In the traditional sort of midstream domain of the trading companies, we have one of the world's largest rail seaborne transshipment terminals for refined products on the Baltic. And we also control assets in Latin America and elsewhere in the Black Sea. We're also, since 2012, have been a fairly sizable refiner of petroleum in the European market with our purchase of the Ingolstadt and the Antwerp refineries, former assets held by the independent refiner Petroplus. So you can see it's become a much more integrated industrial model than our beginnings as simply a trader of oil out of Russia. What's been the impetus for the trading companies to diversify out of pure trading? One, purely and simply, is the fact that as volatility within the oil market has diminished in the aftermath of 2008-2009, pure trading margins for the bulk of the major trading houses have diminished. And therefore, as I said, the opportunity to invest in assets, in our case, very much downstream petroleum, refined products, terminaling and exports, and oil refineries, has come about because of some of the competitive pressures that have come to bear on the European refining sector because of competition from new, more complex refining capacity being built in the growth markets in the emerging world. And what it's led to, as I've said earlier on, is a tenfold increase in the recourse to public debt and equity for companies such as ours. This is a chart showing the financing of the top five or six trading companies over the last decade, and you can see that there's been a tenfold increase in the recourse to financing that we and our peers have made to finance this diversification on the physical side of our business. And there you can see where we're operating. As I said, originally 60-70% of our business was in Europe. Now less than 50% of our $93 billion 2012 revenues came out of Europe, and an increasing amount coming from the emerging markets in Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa, and in the Americas. And there's also been diversification across the sorts of products that we've been trading. Began life as a crude trading company, but now crude accounts for 30% or less of our business, and we've moved much more into refined petroleum products, into natural gas, and into coal. And the volumes, of course, are not insubstantial. In physical terms, around 130 million tonnes. That's equivalent to about 2.5 million barrels per day, which is sort of the equivalent of a small-scale OPEC producer in production terms. So this is a business that has grown very, very rapidly over the last 14-15 years or so, and which has diversified geographically, has diversified in terms of the physical products that we're moving around the world, and has also diversified in terms of where we sit in the value chain. But I think it's very important to stress that although probably 95% of the volumes that we move are hedged, we're very much a company that is embedded in the physical infrastructure business. And therefore, obviously, our ability to hedge, our ability to find instruments that give us the flexibility for the diverse number of products and geographies we operate in is very, very important. And there you can just see how we've sort of grown out from a primarily European base to one that is really active in most parts of the world. A few observations from a trading company perspective in terms of the nature of physical oil markets themselves and trading. And one which sometimes surprises people is that companies like ours, and indeed integrated operators within the market, are almost wholly indifferent to whether the price of crude oil is at $20 a barrel, $50 a barrel, or $100 per barrel. When you go and meet with your child, your fellow parents at the school parents meeting, and people find out you're from a trading company, and they all say, oh, you must be very happy that the price of crude is $110 per barrel. Well, no, not really, because that's tying up an awful lot of capital for us, which could otherwise be put to more productive uses. What the trading companies and what the integrated oil companies are interested in is arbitrage opportunities. Finding where there is disequilibrium in the physical market and moving supply from areas of surplus to areas of shortage. And that may either be in the geographical sense, where there are price differentials between two different geographies, and we use a global infrastructure network and logistical network, be it pipelines, oil tankers, trucks or rail cars, to move product from, as I said, areas of shortage to areas of surplus to areas of shortage. It may be cross-commodity arbitrage, where there are price differentials which encourage us either to blend or to process or to transform energy, either in power plants or in refineries. And finally, of course, it may be time-related arbitrage, where we will undertake carry trades via storage and financing to take advantage of price differentials between prompt and forward delivery. And this is the classic sort of trading company model. For some, this is indicative of a set of operators which are taking advantage of volatility within the market. But actually, if you look at what the trading companies do, what they're trying to do is sort of oil the links in the global supply chain and ultimately smoothing out physical disequilibrium when it materializes in the market. there's obviously, as we've heard, a diversity of actors in the oil market. There's the producers, be they national oil companies or international oil companies, who may have slightly different objectives in overall market terms. And there's a whole raft of different consumers of different energy commodities active in the market as well. This is a chart from the US EIA, and in a sense, I would question their positioning of us in this box of traders, hedgers, speculators, and investors. I would rather see that red bit of the chart somewhere between the producers and the consumers, but nonetheless, we'll accept that from the EIA. And obviously, there are a raft of counterparties for physical players like us who are essential to allow us to hedge and set off the price risk that we face each and every day in moving a barrel of oil or a BTU of gas from point A to point B. And then, of course, there are the policymakers who themselves can influence the way prices are formed in the energy markets, particularly when you look at some of the regulatory measures that are in place, both on the demand side and the supply side of the market. And I'll touch on that in a bit more detail in a moment. Jeff, I think, recounted fairly clearly the sort of growing consensus within the market that ultimately, over the medium and longer term, it is what's happening in the physical market today, or perceptions of what will happen in the physical market tomorrow, which remain the primary drivers of oil and energy prices as a whole. But, you know, there is still a school of thought that in the very short term, the influx of money or the outflow of money in the paper markets can have a sort of amplifying effect in the very short term. But I think we would certainly subscribe to the view that it is ultimately what's going on in the physical market which will tend to impact upon prices over the medium and longer term and on a more sustained basis. One of the characteristics of oil in particular, which I think we have to bear in mind when we're looking at shifts in prices and volatility in prices, certainly in the crude oil market, is how very inelastic to price both supply and demand are in the short term, classic sort of supply-demand curves. And that means that it requires quite a large shift in the price of crude oil before you get a fundamental change in behavior, either from producers or consumers within the market. And you can make the argument that that is partly to do with the market structure and the sort of distortions that exist in the physical market vis-a-vis the perfect sort of market, theoretical perfect market model that one would typically expect to see. So we've heard a lot about the inflow of money into commodities markets and derivatives markets and the perception that that can play a role in driving prices. And I would submit, and I think a lot of the academic research tends to agree, that when you look at the supply side of the oil market, it is fairly heavily regulated. And it's regulated by a cartel of producers, namely OPEC, which tries to adjust the supply of oil to the market in line with volume and price objectives that individual producers within that organization may have. Some people have noted, however, that there is a degree of asymmetry in OPEC response to changes in price, and that at times OPEC producers can act rather more quickly to restrict supply of oil to the market when prices are falling than they increase supply of oil to the market when prices are rising. On the demand side, we have a couple of reasons why fundamentally demand is inelastic to changes in price. The first is that demand is increasingly concentrated in transportation markets, where there are very few alternatives to oil in the end-user markets. And therefore, it takes a very large shift in prices before consumers will respond. The second and probably more important driver of inelasticity on the demand side is the fact that all of oil demand growth over the last decade has come from the emerging markets. And in those emerging markets, in many cases, end-user prices are completely disconnected from international crude oil prices. And therefore, consumers are not necessarily receiving the price signals which arise in crude oil prices from $80 to $90 or $110 per barrel might otherwise generate. And so I think when we look at price formation and we look at volatility in markets to do with the G7 and the Riyadh strands of policymaking, and really coming back to one of David's points about why, if academic research is suggesting that it's not about financial flows, it's much more about other things, these sort of policy-related decisions, whether it's taxes in the OECD markets, whether it's subsidies in the emerging markets, or whether it's regulated supply to the market, are much more difficult issues for politicians in those countries to grapple with. And in many cases, that is why the derivatives markets have been the focus of so much attention. It's also worth another characteristic, particularly in the oil market, worth bearing in mind when one is embarking on a program of regulation and certainly looking at benchmarks, is the wide disparity in quality. Oil, petroleum is not homogeneous. It is highly heterogeneous. And we talk about what is the price of oil, $110 per barrel. Well, that's the price for Brent crude oil, one of the key global markers in the marketplace. But in terms of density and sulfur content, it's one of a myriad of different quality crude oils. Similarly, on the refined products side of the market, there is a huge divergence between geographies and between markets in the qualities of oil that is being traded in the physical sphere. And I think one of the appeals, I think, that physical market players would make is that when you're looking at benchmarks and when you're looking at regulating benchmarks, you must not consider oil as a sort of vanilla homogeneous product. It is a highly heterogeneous set of products, which in a sense need regarding and looking at in a sort of a different way than much more standardized financial instruments overall. And I think it's interesting to note that most market outlooks on the physical side see the growth in international trade, and this is something that affects us as a physical market player. The growth in refined products trade over the next decade is likely to be much more rapid than that of crude oil trade going forward. And of course, that throws up a number of logistical and investment issues which operators such as ourselves need to consider. We're moving downstream into the refined products part of the business at a time when regulatory change on the physical side is also imposing very heavy investment requirements, whether it's in terms of double-hulled tankers, whether it's in terms of tightening refined product specifications, the removal of sulfur from marine bunker fuels, and other areas affecting the operation of refineries, there is a massive investment requirement for physical players to comply with a whole raft of new physical regulations over and above what is being required from physical market players in terms of reporting on their derivatives market activity. And I think it's something that's worth bearing in mind. There is a time aspect here as well, and from getting a barrel of oil out of the ground to getting it through storage, transportation, and processing to putting gasoline into an end user's car at the end of that process can take anything between 3 weeks and 3 months. And so it's vital for companies such as ourselves, who are present across the value chain, that we can hedge this price risk that we confront each and every day with each and every barrel that we move. As I said, Gunvor hedges about 95% plus of its physical exposure, probably a little bit less hedging undertaken in terms of coal and solid fuel trading, but nonetheless, the bulk of our physical volumes are indeed hedged. And we need to have risk management tools that are flexible enough to reflect the portfolio of products that we're trading and the different levels of risk that we have for the different sorts of products, transport, storage, and processing that we undertake. And I think it is worth asking the question if the evolving slate of risk management and financing tools that are emerging after the new program of regulatory reform, is it still going to provide the necessary flexibility that ourselves and other physical market players actually require? A couple of words on benchmarks, and really this is just a sort of reflection on where we are today and where we might be headed in future in terms of pricing benchmarks. Not really to talk about the regulatory side of it, I'll come on to that in about 1 minute, but just to recognize that we have a set of crude oil benchmarks within the market, Brent, WTI, and Dubai. And probably if we were inventing an international oil market from scratch today, we might not necessarily start with those benchmarks. Nonetheless, they are embedded within the system and they have a degree of industrial acceptance, despite a number of shortcomings, which I suspect will mean they'll be with us for quite a considerable time to come. There's a list there of six or seven sort of idealized characteristics of benchmarks. And I suspect, you know, physical liquidity, transportation infrastructure, most important, hedgeability, a multitude of suppliers and consumers, and an ability to sell on cargoes within the physical market, political stability. All of these are important, and all of these, to a certain extent, I suggest, may act as a barrier to the rapid introduction of new benchmarks within the crude oil pricing system, be that some of the new crudes being produced in the United States, or Urals into Europe, or Espo into the Asia Pacific. So I suspect we're going to be stuck with Brent, WTI, and Dubai, maybe a degree of secondary indexing off those for some time to come. I just want to finish up with some thoughts, some sort of isolated thoughts almost, on regulatory changes and how they may impact on the day-to-day life of companies such as ourselves. And we've talked a little bit about the benchmarks, and we've lost a bit of the granularity on the text there. And I think generally there's a high degree of acceptability within the industry of, with the IOSCO principles on benchmarks that have been worked on and refined over the past couple of years. And I speak as someone who was involved in the process in a previous life at the IEA in Paris. As I say, I think there's a fairly high degree of acceptability of the sort of common sense and practicality of those guidelines in terms of benchmarks. I think there's a bit more concern about the sort of overarching view on benchmarks that may be coming out of Brussels and elsewhere, which tends to treat energy products and commodities more generally as if they were exactly the same as financial instruments. I think the sign is that some of the more punitive elements of the European proposal, such as the 25% threshold and unlimited legal liability, both on price contributors and the price reporting agencies, that reportedly has been pushed to one side. And I think that's a good thing because I think it would have fundamentally overturned contributions to this voluntary price reporting system. And I think what you probably would have seen was a lot of companies in the physical sphere actually ceasing to report deals, which I think is not something that the legislation is setting out to achieve at all. I think there are some definitional issues still to be dealt with. I think we need to ensure that what is undoubtedly not a perfect system, but the PRA reporting system overall has acceptance amongst the industry. And I think it's important that we maintain a flow of information on a voluntary basis that the current system encourages. And anything that makes or makes more likely some sort of drying up of the flow of information into those gathering and making assessments of the prices is something which would not be welcome for anyone, and indeed could introduce a greater degree of volatility in the market, as well as making hedging of very real physical risks much more difficult. The move of swaps to clearing has obviously already happened, and for a company like Gunvor, which was already clearing the bulk of its business, it's not something that is being overly onerous. But we don't operate in a vacuum, and there are other market counterparties, smaller traders and niche market players, for whom this has been something that is more difficult. It has certainly raised costs, and it, to some extent, there still poses a question about the ability to hedge risk on off-spec products or off-spec cargoes within the market. And I think that is something we may well see the departure from the market of some of those smaller players because of the money they need to bring into the clearing process, or indeed the capital they need to hold for uncleared OTC business, all of which regulation is done for the most laudable of reasons. But if you're actually squeezing participation within the market and you're putting in place a more concentrated set of participants within the market, that may be in a sense a sort of unintended consequence of the regulation going forward. Just to finish up, some more other regulatory issues. Obviously, position limits versus position management is something that is still being discussed. Proprietary information for a physical player like someone such as ourselves and the market abuse regulations, there's an issue there for us as a refiner, as a small-scale producer. How much operational information are we going to be forced to disclose ahead of time, and does that risk giving some of our competitors an ability to ask prices of us if we're a distressed buyer or seller within the market? And I think that is something that needs to be looked at very, very carefully. Jeff mentioned the squeeze on banks' participation within the commodity sphere overall, not their physical presence, but as providers of derivatives market liquidity, and also as a source of financing, both for commodity trade finance and indeed investment finance. If we're going to encourage the banks basically to withdraw from whole swathes of the commodity market, that may be something that actually impedes physical liquidity within the market and therefore I think needs looking at very carefully. And also other things, you know, worth saying that we are not a bank, and yet some of the requirements or potential requirements on a trading house in terms of risk management requirements and systems that we're being asked to put in place, I think financially for us and for companies like us, it's going to be very onerous. And ultimately, those costs will have to be passed on to consumers of energy via higher energy prices. And just a final thought, I hope one of the things I may have persuaded you of today, in contrast to one of David's slides, trading houses are not unregulated. Every step of moving a barrel of oil from point A to point B is very heavily regulated. And of course, we have signed up to and are very willing participants in a discourse with regulators and policymakers on things like Dodd-Frank, emerging EU legislation. We're heavily regulated by the exchanges on which we operate and other financial rules too. So we're very happy to have the opportunity to have this discourse with you today, and I look forward to the next presentations and indeed the discussion we're going to have after lunch. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, David. I have to cheerfully admit that when I use the word unregulated, I rather typically narrowly mean not regulated by me, but I absolutely accept that there are other forms of regulation. Other than those by financial services regulators. What I took from that excellent presentation, amongst other things, was a feeling that, from your perspective, as a physical market participant, a sense that financial markets had hitherto worked quite well for you and your firm, but some concerns about whether that will continue to be the case going forward.
I think it's, I think everyone buys into the need for oversight and for transparency and better reporting. But I think what for us is potentially problematic is treating a company like ours, which is first and foremost a physical operator, as if we were a financial institution or a bank. We're not. And if you load upon physically oriented companies overly onerous investment requirements in whole new reporting systems, we've got to pass that on. We've got to pass that cost on. And therefore, you have this sort of conflict between the two policy-making strands that I talked about to begin with. But I certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that we are not very happy participants in the provision of more information and greater oversight and measures to avoid manipulation or systemic risk in the financial markets, because we buy into that wholeheartedly.
Well, thank you very much indeed, David. As flagged at the beginning, I suggest that we take a short coffee break now. And by short, I really do mean short. I'd like to be back here starting again at 11:30. So it's probably time to get up the stairs, grab a cup of coffee, drink it, and then come back down again. And then we'll hear from Bahatine and from Scott.